All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I have to tell you, I'm really pleased with this first section of the show, because no matter how it goes, the story, no matter how much I might stutter, the story here is incredibly important. And a book called Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. And it's by Lisa Bloom. And Lisa's story is incredible. I'm telling you, you pick it up and you can't put it down, and you just read through it. And if you're like me and you paid attention to that, and your heart was just ripped to shreds when you saw what was going on, and you didn't understand it completely, you had general ideas about what was going on, Lisa Bloom's book, Suspicion Nation, will take you right through it and just lay bare all of this stuff. The lies from the defense, the refusal of the prosecution to prosecute, you know, in-depth interviews with key trial participants. And, she addresses, in addition to that, she talks about that and lays bare what happened. She also talks about this society and what is it in this society that allows so many Trayvon Martins to happen again and again. Lisa's a trial lawyer, national journalist, and award-winning author. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction, Michael. I'm so glad you enjoyed my book.
Well, I'll tell you, I wasn't exaggerating. I could not put it down. I mean, I read it, all the way through in maybe a day and a half. I just concentrated on it. And it was one of those things where you just didn't want to stop, because.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think, when I say that, I know I'm not alone. And, when I say about the reaction to the Zimmerman trial, we always say it was Trayvon Martin on trial. In a way, it was actually, in terms of when we talk about the uh-huh. Trayvon Martin case, because he was, in fact, very much on trial, even though it was the defendant was Zimmerman.
Yes.
Let's talk about this, though, because when I say that, it's interesting, because I was so enraged. I was so angry. I could see, different things perceptually about what had happened, what had happened in the case, what wasn't done, what I thought was done, and whatever. But it never came together for me in the way that you put this together. And I'd like you to talk about this, because going into the case, you initially believed that the defense, that Zimmerman and his team, had all the chips on their side. But after digging into it, you determined that the prosecution actually had a good shot at winning. What changed your mind?
Right. So, listen, I've been covering trials for many years, and it's so interesting that you're talking about mass incarceration later on in the hour, because that's a big passion of mine as well. And so I know that too many people in America are incarcerated for long prison terms for crimes they didn't commit. And our criminal justice system has many flaws, but requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt is not one of them. And so while it certainly seemed to me that Trayvon Martin, an unarmed teenager walking home, shot and killed, seemed like a terrible injustice, I wanted to see the evidence in the courtroom before I was going to reach any conclusion about George Zimmerman's guilt. So I was assigned to cover the case for MSNBC and NBC. I watched every minute of it. And before the trial, and I tell this story in the book, I reviewed the evidence, I reviewed the timeline, the map of where it happened, the physical evidence, George Zimmerman's statements, and I thought to myself, well, this is interesting. He tells a plausible self-defense story. He told the story right from the beginning. It's internally consistent. And, he's really the only witness to talk about what happened. There were a lot of other witnesses, but they saw only bits and pieces, and some of their stories were inconsistent. So the first week of the trial, as I was covering it on air for MSNBC, I noticed that a lot of witnesses for the prosecution were not particularly strong, and I thought, this looks like it's going to be a self-defense case. But about halfway through, I had my aha moment, and I talk about that in the book. And that's when I started reviewing the evidence myself. And I noticed that there was an absolutely crucial piece of evidence that the prosecution was not arguing. And that is that George Zimmerman, on videotape made the day after the shooting, shows that his gun was holstered inside his pants and behind him, over his backside. It was also covered by a shirt and a jacket. Now, that's extremely important, because his story is he was down on his back with Trayvon Martin on top of him, knees to elbows, and he says that Trayvon saw the gun, reached for the gun, and threatened to kill him. And so at that moment, Zimmerman says, he pulled the gun and shot in self-defense. Well, unless Trayvon Martin had X-ray vision, there is no way he could have seen the gun in that position. It shocked me to see that on the videotape, and it disturbed me even more that the prosecution wasn't arguing this. And I started to think to myself, if they're not arguing this, what else are they not arguing? And so I reviewed the evidence anew, And I discovered a great deal of evidence that they weren't arguing. And I started to talk about this a lot on the air on MSNBC and on the Today Show the last week of trial. I knew this case was going to result in an acquittal, unfortunately, and I said that on the air before the verdict, because both sides were arguing reasonable doubt. And so an acquittal was the only possible outcome. I don't blame the jury. I blame the professionals in the courtroom. And so after the case was over, you know, like you, I was disgusted. Like millions of people who took to the streets, I was very unhappy. And I was especially unhappy because so many people said, well, you know, the system played out, the jury has spoken, move on. And I wanted to examine what happened. I wanted to interview the witnesses. I wanted to interview the jurors. I wanted to find out what went on because I think this case was important. I think it was iconic. I think that in 50 years from now, people are going to look at this case as the Emmett Till case of the early 21st century. And I wanted to create a record of what went wrong in this case and what a terrible injustice it was. And the investigation I did only made it 10 times worse in terms of what I discovered. And that's all what's in my book, Suspicion Nation.
Mm-hmm. Now, Lisa, you actually say you had a very moving kind of and you know, maybe some people would pass over it, but I was just really struck by it. You mentioned that after the trial and that you were in New York and somebody yelled to you, Lisa, what happened?
Yeah.
And you basically struck you that yes, the prosecution blew it. Now this was not a you know, and it feels really odd to me to be arguing for it. You know, the prosecution should have been harder, but in something like this, you know, where you so much was at stake here. And both sides. I mean, it was sort of like so much was at stake in terms of, on the one hand, the people had a lot at stake in terms of really getting to the truth of what happened. And on the other hand, I think some of the various tendencies in the justice system and all this other stuff and the forces in the justice system had a stake too, because it was all the stuff that was up. You know, the stand your ground rule, the idea of, you know, again, this mass incarceration and what is the position of black youth in society. You know, and so all that was at stake. But you said that the prosecutors, blew it. And you also coupled that with the idea that, look, the most powerful, these are not people that just rolled off of the Bunyan truck or whatever it is, Bunyan truck. I couldn't think of anything else to say. But, you know, they're not people who just like sort of woke up one morning and said, oh, I'm going to court and prosecuting. These are people who are top-notch prosecutors, supposedly. And
yeah, I think, you know, a lot of what I do is television commentary, where I generally get 3 minutes to say something. And when the demonstrator yelled out at me, hey, Lisa Bloom, what happened, you know, as this march was going by, I realized that this is not something I can explain in 1 minute or in 3 minutes or in 10 minutes. You know, this is something that requires an exhaustive investigation and a 300-page book. And that's why I basically stopped everything in my life for the last 6 months to investigate this and write this book, because I wanted to explain to everybody who has that gut feeling that something went wrong in this case that you're right, that we should not just move on. We should expose this injustice. And I thought, at a minimum, that's something that I can do. I've been a trial lawyer myself since 1986. I've covered every high-profile trial in America for the last 20 years. And this case was different. And it was different because the prosecutors bungled the case from start to finish. The police also made terrible mistakes in the case. You know, Trayvon Martin, in a very real sense, was put on trial, as you say, and Trayvon Martin did not get a fair trial, not even close.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, that's a point. I mean, it's like you make a point which I found very heavy, is that there wasn't even the sort of contestation that needed to be going on, that in fact, on all of the key points, that the prosecution actually ended up conceding and you know, finding unity with the defense.
Right. So, for example, I go through the big six mistakes that they made in the book. For example, race. They were afraid to talk about race in the courtroom. And this is a mistake, by the way, that they've repeated in the Jordan Davis case recently, which is why they got a hung jury on the charge of Michael Dunn killing Jordan Davis. Race was very much a factor in the courtroom. The defense, very comfortably, if illogically, talked about race in the courtroom. They said that Trayvon Martin was a match, that's their word, match, to two African-American criminals, burglars, who had been in the neighborhood 6 months prior. Well, the only match was skin color. Trayvon Martin was not a burglar. He was not a criminal. He had no criminal history, no record of violence whatsoever. The prosecution should have been on their feet objecting to this characterization of a dead teenager who was not there to speak for himself. And instead, the jury got the impression that this neighborhood was overrun with black criminality, when in fact there was no evidence of that whatsoever. There was no evidence that even the criminality in that neighborhood was greater than the 20% of that was the black community. So, I mean, that was just a false impression. That was a racist impression to attribute the wrongs of two African-Americans, the burglars, to all African-Americans is the very definition of racism. But the prosecution never said so in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lisa Bloom, author of Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. Lisa, you know, one of the things that you bring up in this, and when you're talking about race, I mean, it's really true. Race was there. It was like the big elephant just sitting there, you know, and it was sitting there, and it was, and everyone knew that, you know, and this is the thing, is everyone knew that, and there were manifestations of it, as you're saying, in terms of the broad sweeping generalizations and the characterizations of all Black people as criminals or something, and coming, but even in Zimmerman's thinking, it's well documented that the cat really had a Jones about Black people, you know, and there's all this other stuff that was going on, and it was also the Rachel Gentel testimony, which, yes, I thought just concentrated so much of how much race is actually at the heart of a lot of this.
You know, probably my favorite chapter, if I can have a favorite chapter in my own book, is where I tell Rachel Gentel's story. Mm-hmm. And people will remember she was the 19-year-old young woman, heavyset young woman who testified and was really a figure on social media. People were saying very demeaning, offensive, racist things about her. Others were defending her at the time. But from the point of view of the trial, what was so important is that she had the most important story to tell in the courtroom, because she was on the phone with Trayvon Martin at the time that he saw Zimmerman. He was afraid of Zimmerman. He was trying to get away from him. When Zimmerman did disappear briefly, Trayvon then went back to joking around with Rachel Gentel, teasing her about doing her hair. So this is a very lighthearted conversation he was having with her. This was not a homicidal killer waiting to kill George Zimmerman, the way that he described it. And most importantly, Rachel Gentel says that she overheard the very beginning of the altercation, where Trayvon Martin said, "Why are you following me?" which was a perfectly reasonable question. And George Zimmerman said, "What are you doing around here?" which is an obnoxious thing to say. Then she heard a thump on Trayvon Martin's chest, where his phone cord was attached, which certainly sounds like Zimmerman assaulting him. And then she heard the sound of wet grass, so Trayvon Martin going down. And then she heard him say, "Get off, get off," which is a defensive thing to say, you know, "Get off of me." But all of that was lost. Why? Because the prosecution failed to properly prepare her. And I talk about how she was sitting alone in a room waiting to be prepared, how she had a minor speech impediment, an underbite that has nothing to do with credibility, but that caused her to mumble a little bit and be difficult to hear. You know, that's the kind of thing that the prosecutor should have brought to the jury's attention and should have given them some extra time to prepare her. You know, we trial attorneys have to put people on the stand all the time who are not necessarily the greatest communicators. So what? You prepare them. You go over the testimony. You give them the practice questions. You give them some practice cross-examination. It's absolutely outrageous that they didn't do that with Rachel Gentel. And that's probably one of the biggest reasons why they lost the case.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because one of the things that, I mean, the Rachel Gentel case, I also was really moved by that chapter. And I thought, you know, because this young woman went through so much hell. I mean, just to begin with, her very close friend, you know, and she's then, you know, is murdered, and she's then accused of lying and covering her tracks as if she did something wrong.
Yeah.
And, but it's all couched in this thing, even the assault on her for, "We can't understand what she's saying," because she's speaking Black English. You know, just a terrible, terrible, you know, massive amount of an assault against her. And I was really moved by that. But I also thought your point about the preparation. I have to tell you, Lisa, there were a number of times in your book that I had to sit back and say, "Damn, next time I'm arrested, I want Lisa as my lawyer."
Because, well, thank you. Yeah. I'll be there for you, Michael.
Okay, all right. I'm going to hold you to that. You know, the thing is that I'm reading this, and I'm looking at, and all the points that you make about the preparation, and then you say, here's how you should have done it. You know, why do you think that this preparation, again, these are not bumpkins. Why do you think they didn't do that preparation?
Well, you know, thank you for the compliment, and I do like to think I'm a good lawyer. I do practice law, but honestly, the things that I'm pointing out in the book are lawyering 101, like preparing a witness. Please, this does not take, you know, 20 years of practicing law to put together that you have to prepare your witnesses. And you're right, Bernie De La Rionda, who was the lead prosecutor, bragged that he had won 80 out of 81 cases before this trial. So he certainly knew how to win a case. I think what you're asking ultimately is what I call the blow it or throw it question. Did they blow the case, or did they intentionally throw the case? And I've had a number of readers of my book actually argue with me based on what they read in my book, and they feel adamantly that the prosecution intentionally threw the case. You know, I myself, I'm not going to come to that conclusion unless I have some hard evidence. I think it's hard to have a conspiracy with a lot of different people, and, you know, nobody reveals it, so I'm not going there. I will say there are a few facts that indicate that they threw it. Those facts are that Angela Corey, right after the verdict, right in front of the cameras, had a big smile, and she said the system worked. I think the police are vindicated by the acquittal, the police that these prosecutors have to work with every day. I have the medical examiner in the book who said behind the scenes, none of the prosecutors, the police, thought that Trayvon Martin was truly a victim. But overall, I think in a sense it's almost worse than that, and that is that they just didn't put the effort in this case to win it. You know, this was a case that was foisted upon them by the public. Remember, for 45 days, they didn't even arrest George Zimmerman. It took protests all across the country for that arrest to happen. I think they just didn't care. They just didn't believe in their case. And ultimately, when it was assigned to them, they just did a perfunctory job. They just put the evidence on, but without connecting the dots, without, you know, really connecting the facts and the law, doing a strong closing argument. The closing argument was a disaster for them. I think their heart was just not in the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get into the closing argument a little bit, but I did actually want to ask you one question because, you know, one of the things, and I know I'm not going to dig into all the just mind-numbing and actually astounding exposure you do around what was actually possible to present and didn't get presented, but there was one thing that really struck me, and that was the forensic evidence and the complete disregard for any of that, taking any of that on, because, and in particular, the idea that, you know, that there was this, you know, related to the infamous call, the Lauer call, the call where they actually had somebody screaming on there, and it was finally determined that, well, we can't really determine who it was, but it was really closely linked to, you had what, 1,000 people saying that, oh no, that was George Zimmerman screaming, and 3 people saying that, you know, it was Trayvon screaming. And yet, and there was no attempt to even dissect that, and you bring out that it was actually more than possible to get really close to thinking that it was Trayvon there, if not proving that it was Trayvon screaming.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Rachel Gentile said that Trayvon Martin had a high-pitched voice, a baby voice, she said at one point on another relation to something else. But the man screaming on that 911 call just before the gunfire rings out has a high-pitched voice. The prosecution never connected that for the jury. We know that George Zimmerman did not have a high-pitched voice because we heard him on several audio recordings in the courtroom, even though he didn't testify. And what you're talking about is a scientific theory called pneumothorax that one of the expert witnesses wanted to present for the prosecution that would have shown that the moment that the bullet went into Trayvon's body, there were 2 fragments that punctured his lung and caused this condition called pneumothorax that would have prevented him from breathing and speaking and making any sounds immediately. Well, that's a perfect match to the fact that on the 911 call, as soon as the gunfire rings out, the screaming stops. So it would make more sense. It would tend to make more likely the fact that it was Trayvon Martin screaming for help. I think that I put together my own theory in the book based on all the evidence, what I think happened. I think Zimmerman pulled the gun out early in the altercation because he was afraid of Trayvon Martin and he wanted to control him. And I think Trayvon Martin was screaming horribly, poignantly for about 40 seconds because there was a madman pointing a gun at him and he was scared for his life. He turned out to be right.
Absolutely, yeah. I really agree with you. You know, I want to get into this. Well, let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Lisa Bloom. Lisa's an attorney, a journalist, and the author of Suspicion Nation, The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It. A really important book. I really urge everyone who's listening to this to go out and get that book. You've really got to. It's going to answer a lot of questions and open up a whole lot more, I hope. So, Lisa, you know, let's talk about the closing argument. Because once again, Lisa, I don't ever cheer for prosecutors, okay? But when you developed your own closing argument, what should have been, what could have been, what should have been, I was like, yes, nail them! But, you know, but the thing is that you really did show this, that these guys actually, again, the conceding everything, and at the end of it, they didn't argue anything. And you said that they abrogated their responsibility to give the jurors a roadmap to conviction. And I thought that was really important. They never explained the charges. They, you know, all of these things. Can you talk to people about the closing argument, really, of the prosecution really did concentrate what went on in the trial?
Yeah, one of the things I felt that I could offer by writing this book is the way these cases usually go, because a lot of people watch this case, but they're not necessarily familiar with criminal trials or with murder trials. The prosecution in this case never offered its own theory of the case. They never offered their own story as to what they thought happened just before Trayvon Martin was shot. And the defense always had their story. George Zimmerman said he shot in self-defense. He said that, you know, there was an altercation, that he was down, that Trayvon Martin was on top of him, and he shot in self-defense. Well, the prosecution needed to counter that. And I was shocked that they never did. They essentially went with the defense's version of the case, and they just argued details around the edges. And it was always clear to me that if this jury believes that Zimmerman is down on his back, Trayvon Martin is on top of him, he's threatening to kill him, he's banging his head on the concrete, as Zimmerman said, he's threatening to grab the gun and shoot him, well, of course the jury is going to acquit him, because that's a very scary story, and frankly, we all have the right to kill in self-defense if our lives are being threatened. I have never seen a murder trial, and I have seen hundreds of them. For 8 years, I hosted a show on Court TV, and almost all we did was watch murder trials. Mm. I have never seen a case where the prosecution did not offer its own theory of the case. The jury will simply not do that job for the prosecution, and they didn't do it here. What they did do in closing argument was ask a lot of questions. That was very odd. You know, why do you think this happened? Why do you think that happened? You can put this together. You don't ask the jury to go into the jury room and put it together themselves. You give them a roadmap to conviction. You put up the law. You emphasize the parts of the law that are helpful to you, that are important, and you plug in the evidence to the law to show how your side is going to win the case, to show them why they should convict. And the prosecution just did not do that. They just asked a series of questions. It was a rambling, disjointed presentation. I have some of the choice quotes in the book. I mean, I was really astounded. You know, they had some passion. They had some quips. And, you know, people who watched the trial with me who aren't trial lawyers said, oh, I thought that was very moving. You know, it's not enough in closing argument to just have some rhetoric and some passion. You have to put it together for the jury because, you know, I have the story inside the jury of how they took it, which was, yeah, there was a lot of passion, but we were told not to decide the case based on the evidence. So we had to put that aside. And one of them said, you know, all they gave me was passion. Then they said, don't decide the case based on that. Well, that jacked me up. I think that did jack them up. Mm-hmm. And I also think the prosecution should have known better. They had to have known better.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to move into another section, Lisa, which I'm going to read something from the book. It's very short, but I think it's really important in terms of entering into this new section of the book. And it starts with, please use my story. Please use my tragedy. Please use my broken heart to say to yourself, we cannot let this happen to anybody else's child. And that's from Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother. Now, you go on and you say, Trayvon Martin's death was not a tragic accident. Unforeseeable, unstoppable, as though an asteroid had smashed into the earth without warning, taking a life. Human-made stereotypes and laws created all the conditions that led to the death of Sabrina Fulton's son and that made George Zimmerman's acquittal by far the most likely outcome. Let's talk about that, because I think it's really important the way you actually, after presenting this very, very, you know, powerful, you know, analysis of the case and what was going on. You also then say, but we have to step back because as much as we don't want there to be, there's going to be more Trayvon Martins. And, you know, we've seen it as we've talked about, you know, all the things, and you have a lot of examples, whether it's a young woman who was shot when she was seeking help in after a car accident was at Detroit and, Jordan Davis that just, what just happened there, you know, there's all this stuff that's going on. And you point out that this is rooted in the fabric of society, in the way, the culture, the fabric, the things that are being done that lead to this kind of situation, the mass incarceration, the actually almost the slow genocide that's being unleashed against particularly black people.
Yes. Yes. So the second half of my book is a deep dive into these conditions because I'm tired of everyone being shocked and appalled each time one of these cases happens. Of course, they are shocking and they are appalling, but until we dig down into the root causes and get some change, they're going to continue to happen. So the three biggest factors that were at play here and that have been at play in a number of cases are rampant racial profiling in America, our lax gun laws, and stand your ground. Those are the three factors. The first, racial profiling, we can make some legal changes, but that's really a cultural change we have to make. And so I talk a lot about implicit racial bias, which I think is a really important concept that, frankly, I learned about while I was covering the case and trying to figure out that how is it in America nobody admits to being racist and yet there are so many racially disparate outcomes? You know, how is it that if you ask a group of people, hey, who in this room is a racist, right, no one's going to raise their hand. Everybody considers it a vile insult, which it is. And yet, in our criminal justice system, for example, a black man is four times as likely to be arrested and incarcerated for marijuana possession as a white man. You know, black youths are more likely to be sentenced to long terms than white youths who are being sentenced for the same crimes, especially in our criminal justice system, from beginning to end, from arrest through conviction, through sentencing, through parole. There's no question that everything is worse for African Americans. There's no question that there's a huge advantage to show up with white skin. And yet, this is a system in which most of the participants, I think, are good people. They're people who would say, well, I'm certainly not racist. In fact, many of them are African American or Latino themselves. And so how do we have this problem? And I think the answer is implicit racial bias. For those who aren't familiar with implicit racial bias, there's a test you can take online for free. I have the citation in my book. I took the test myself. It turns out that 80% of white Americans test for moderate or severe implicit racial bias against blacks, and 50% of blacks do as well, which is very disturbing. This is a test you take that you can't cheat, you can't trick, and it tests for whether you have these biases subliminally. And it's really an eye-opener that, you know, we see African-Americans differently. There are so many studies, for example, of a black face and a white face that are in a sort of identical facial expressions, and people overwhelmingly say the black face is more hostile. They take a young black man and they have him shove a white man on a video, and something like two-thirds of the subjects say that's an aggressive act. But when it's flipped, a white man shoving a black man, only 17% say that's an aggressive act. And most people say, oh, they were just horsing around. So there's no question that in the way that we perceive African Americans, we see them as more hostile. We see them as more aggressive. This plays out in our educational system because African American boys in particular are more likely to be suspended or expelled just at skyrocketing numbers, and it plays out in our criminal justice system. And I think until we address this root problem, we're never going to advance.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I want to, well, basically, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, damn, there's so much more I want to talk about, Lisa. You know, let's just one thing very quickly. Can we talk a little bit about the stand your ground rule? Because that's something I think that really is, you know, because it wasn't invoked in the Zimmerman case does not mean that it's somehow disappearing or it's not as, you know, intense and as oppressive as it actually is. Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, stand your ground was very confusing in the Zimmerman case. First of all, it was part of the reason why he wasn't arrested for those 45 days is because of stand your ground, because the police thought he had the right to stand your ground. Then he was arrested. He had the right to a pretrial stand your ground hearing that would have exonerated him, potentially. He chose not to have that hearing. He went to trial in front of the jury. Nobody argued stand your ground in the trial, except in closing argument. It was mentioned briefly. But then stand your ground came in as part of the standard self-defense jury instruction. The judge read to the jury that George Zimmerman had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force. And the jurors afterwards said, as part of their decision-making process, they thought George Zimmerman had the right to stand his ground. So anybody who says that stand your ground was not part of the Zimmerman case is not familiar with, you know, these details, which are really not details, I mean, because these were pivotal parts of the jury's decision-making.
Mm-hmm. All right, Lisa, thank you very much. It's a very powerful book, and people, again, I got to tell you, go read this book. Get this book. Spread it around. This is an extremely, intensely important book. It's inside. It's Suspicion Nation, the Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It, and it's by Lisa Bloom. And Lisa's been our guest today. She's a trial lawyer, national journalist, and award-winning author. And Lisa, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. And I would love to hear from your listeners on Twitter. My name is Lisa Bloom, so sound off over there.